This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Over a century ago, a scientist set up one of the first microbiology labs in the United States. Today, that lab is called the National Institutes of Health.
He was involved in many, if not most, of the major microbiology and public health infectious disease efforts of the late 19th century.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll learn the history of the NIH on its 125th birthday. We'll also listen in as students in Pennsylvania protest budget cuts to education. And we'll talk to the author of a new children's book with Goldilocks and Three Dinosaurs. Plus, we'll spend an academic minute with some Neanderthals trying to act smart. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Earlier this year, on August 27th to be exact, the National Institutes of Health turned 125 years old. Dr. David Morins, an epidemiologist and senior advisor at the NIH, has chronicled the triumphs and tribulations of the man who started it all, NIH's founder, Dr. Joseph Kenyon. Margot Kern from the NIH has the story.
Joe Kenyon was an unknown physician, a young man of in his 20s who joined the Marine Hospital Service in 1886 and set up a laboratory, one of the first microbiology laboratories in the United States. And that laboratory became the National Institutes of Health.
A turning point in Dr. Kenyon's career was his involvement in implementing public health measures in San Francisco during the plague.
The San Francisco experience was kind of the fulcrum of his life and in many ways a tragic occurrence, because he was assigned by the U.S. Surgeon General to go to San Francisco and set up quarantine operations to prevent plague from coming in. And in that role as the representative of the federal government, he essentially ran afoul of California politics. And the California politics were that California was then somewhat of a cowboy state and a strong defender of states' rights against federal intervention in any sphere. And when the federal government came in to institute quarantine, the California governor essentially declared war on the federal government, and Kenyon was the representative, and he became the scapegoat in a big struggle between a powerful state and the federal government, and he was sacrificed in that struggle.
Tensions in California ran so high, in fact, that Kenyon had to carry a gun.
He carried a gun, and he was under threat of physical harm, and there was a $7,000 reward for his death put out by shadowy interests in California, supposedly. And he had to be protected by the police and by the United States Army. It was really a bad situation, and he had to bear up under it with stoicism and try to maintain his humanity during the whole thing.
Dr. Moran says it's difficult to pinpoint Dr. Kenyon's greatest accomplishment because he was involved in so many different endeavors.
He was an eclectic guy. He did a lot of different things. And I would say his legacy is that he covered the not only the depth but the breadth of the brand new field of microbiology. And he was involved in many, if not most, of the major microbiology and public health infectious disease efforts of the late 19th century. Everything from pasteurization of milk to clean water supply to treatment of diseases with brand new medical treatments. And, he was not just a quarantine specialist or even a public health specialist. He was a physician who found multiple unique ways through public health and medical and immunological tools to improve life. And I think that's the way he looked at it. I think he'd want to be remembered as a person who did as much as he possibly could for the general health and well-being of people in the United States and the world.
Recently, the exact date of the founding of the Hygienic Laboratory, which is now the National Institutes of Health, was determined.
We're certain that that date is in August 1887, and we're reasonably certain it was 27 August. So NIH now has a birthday.
Dr. Morins explains why he believes that knowing NIH's birthday is important.
I think that for the public and for the scientists, knowing who we are and where we came from, you know, it's not in our mission to be historians. We're scientists and we do, you know, cutting edge, world class science. But I think it really, in intangible ways that are perhaps a bit hard to explain, I think that helping us know who we are, where we came from, and what our history is also helps us go forward. If we know our legacy, it inspires us and motivates us and tells us what track we've been on, and it points us in the direction of where that track is going. So I think it's a positive thing to know about who we are in many respects, and hopefully a little bit more knowledge of that will be inspiring to the scientists who carry us forward into this century, into the future.
For more about Dr. Kenyon and a recent article published in the journal MBio, visit niaid.nih.gov. For NIH Radio, this is Margot Kern.
This past Valentine's Day, more than 400 students and parents from across Pennsylvania held a rally for public education at the state capitol. This action came a week after the governor announced his plan for the next state budget, a proposal that would carry over last year's $1 billion cuts to education funding. Students demanded that Governor Corbett restore the cut funds and make equitable school funding a top priority in the next state budget. The action was organized by Philadelphia Student Union, Project Peace, Chester Student Leaders, the A-plus Students Teen Block. It was co-sponsored by Juntos and the Campaign for Nonviolent Schools. This segment features highlights from the rally. It was edited by Erica Johnson.
Make some noise if you're here today to tell Governor Corbett to fall back in love with public education. Chester Upland School District has been crippled by Governor Corbett's budget cuts. In January, my teachers were working without pay. Let me say that again. My teachers were working without pay. There's a constant fear of the school shutting down because our budget is not substantial for a quality education. Is that right?
No!
Is that right?
No!
Students get tired of not getting the help they need and not being paid attention to, so they begin to act out. If you don't invest the time and money into something, how do you expect it to grow and have a positive outcome? We deserve to be heard. We matter too. It's time we all take a stand and fight for what is right.
We, the students, parents, and teachers of districts all across Pennsylvania, are fed up. We are making it known that we are through with sitting back and allowing our elected officials to make decisions that have little to no regard for our education, our future, and for our lives.
Governor Corbett, if you invest in our schools, you can close your prison doors.
Governor Corbett is keeping the basic education spending at the same level as last year. In other words, he is carrying over the devastating $1 billion cut from last year. This will make it impossible for us to climb out of the hole that our districts are already in. We are here today to demand better. How can we afford to keep going at this level? Education is a human right, and it should be funded that way.
If we don't prioritize education in this budget, we definitely see more dropouts and less young people going and staying in college.
Education is the only way for youth to make it. And hearing that they won't restore our funding is like our government is giving up before they even try. I'm saying this speech because Governor Corbett, we need your help. It's up to you to do right by us. We're counting on you.
You are giving up on our generation. I'm here to tell you, but your politically correct friends will not. Get your priorities straight and fund for education over prison.
Somos el pueblo que eligió usted.
We are the people of Pennsylvania, and we will not stop organizing until we receive a positive answer.
We want him to restore the cuts in education he previously made. We want him to increase funding in districts that need it.
We are students across Pennsylvania fighting towards a common goal.
It's okay for you to take our education and our futures away, isn't it? You're setting us up for failure because without proper education, the next road is crime. We all know that leads to expressway apprentice prison. What you need to do is fund after-school activities, mentoring programs, college prep programs. Intramural athletics. With these types of activities, there will no longer be a need to put any more funding into prisons. Put your money where our minds are.
This piece was produced by On Blast, a monthly radio show of the Philadelphia Student Union, produced by Philadelphia Student Union members. High school students are organized to demand a high-quality education in the public school system. Still to come, Goldilocks finds herself in a prehistoric pickle. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past shows again, you can find us online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1151. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Moe Willems is one of the most beloved and acclaimed creators of children's books of this generation. The New York Times has compared him to Charles Schulz and named him the biggest new talent to emerge thus far in the new century. Before he turned to making picture books, Moe was a writer and animator on Sesame Street, where he won 6 Emmys. Now Willems is retelling a fairy tale as only he can. Goldilocks and the Three Dinosaurs, as retold by Moe Willems, is a story that will resound just as much with parents as it will for their children. Moe Willems spoke about the new book with The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue.
I have to say, I'm madly in love with this book. It is one of the most delightful books, kids' books, picture books, just plain books, that I've read in a very, very long time. It's Goldilocks and the Three Dinosaurs, as retold by Moe Willems. But there are points where this comes off almost as a parody. It is satire, isn't it?
There are lots of elements about it. You know, there's this rock and roll sense that stories are not written in stone. You know, and as a kid, you've heard this Goldilocks and the Three Bears so many times, and you think, well, I can't mess with that. I mean, that's a big story. That's a permanent story. It's a serious story. And so the idea that you can sort of destroy it by throwing in some, you know, malevolent dinosaurs is a great thing. You know, in the back end papers, I give suggestions for the stories that you can then make. You know, Goldilocks and the Three Condors, Goldilocks and the Three Musketeers, Goldilocks and the 3-foot-long Hoagie.
The Three Robot Dancers being my favorite. There's a sign where you mentioned the malevolent dinosaurs, where Papa Dinosaur says in this loud, booming voice, "Oh boy, it's finally time to leave and go to the, well, someplace else." "Yes," continued Mama Dinosaur, "I sure hope no innocent little succulent child happens to be by our unlocked home while we are someplace else." There's great humor, and I mean, people talk about this a lot of times, about humor that works on various levels, and that's certainly something that I assume was often a part of the writing in Sesame Street, that we see in much of your work as well.
Well, yeah, although I have to say, you know, at Sesame Street, there really was this idea that we wrote on two levels. And by the end of my time there, I started to disagree. I want to write on one level, and that level is funny. And part of the joke of this book is that the entire audience should be able to get that what the narrator is saying is not really the truth. You know,
right.
There's something else going on. And so we're on the inside. We're almost complicit with setting this trap for this poorly supervised little girl.
And the fact that we're assuming that the child who reads this then, well, they may or may not have had an introduction to the original story, to Goldilocks and the Three Bears.
I don't think it's essential. I don't think it's essential. You know, the story holds up on its own. But if you do know the story, then it's a spoof. Then it's an early spoof for you, and then I think that that's empowering.
Give us a sense of how these things come together for you. At what point do you say, okay, I'm going to take on Goldilocks?
Well, you know, this has sort of a weird kind of birth. I put out a sketchbook every year, and I have for the last 20 years for adults, with grown-up stories and weird little things. And I don't know how many years ago, but let's say it's about 10 years ago or so, I did do a Goldilocks and the Three Dinosaurs. Story was completely different, but the title was there. For the first time, I have a book where, like, okay, I know the genre, I know the title, but who are these characters and where do they come from? And the book is actually surprisingly personal for me. I didn't realize it until after I'd finished writing it. But at the end, there are two morals. The second moral is the dinosaur's moral, which is lock the back door, which I think is good advice for anyone.
Absolutely.
But the first moral is, if you're in the wrong story, leave. And that's ultimately what I was writing about. And I found myself in a situation where I was in the wrong story, and it was time for me to leave. And the writing of this book allowed me to see it. So on one level, it's a very, very silly book. And on the other level, it's probably one of the most personal books that I've made.
Personal in what in what sense?
Well, in a personal way.
Meaning
it's
that...
It's personal, Joe.
Yes, it's personal. So I can take that two ways. In that, A, it's none of my business, or B, that, you know, it's something that you put blood, sweat, and tears in.
Absolutely. I'll give you both letters.
Okay, excellent. There's a point in the book where Goldilocks comes into the bedroom, and there's the big bed, the middle bed, and the small bed. And you look at the art on that page, and there is a point where the figure of Goldilocks really pops out at that. Tell us about the artistic process that allows that, because it almost seems like a background with an animated cell over it. But how do you do
that's a very accurate sense of what it is, and I approach this very much like a film. So all of the characters have a little bit of a drop shadow, like they look like they're on a cell level, so that they do pop. And part of it is that, you know, on a metaphoric level, she's not where she should be. She doesn't quite integrate into the background. And so the line quality is a little bit different in that drawing, the background versus the character. The character's a little more in focus. And there is this sort of drop shadow. These are all things that I think guide the emotional sense of the character and things that I would hope that people don't notice. But you did. So,
and
disappointed me, Joe.
I apologize. And when you talk about what people notice and what people don't notice, I assume when the three dinosaurs are charging in to get Goldilocks, who has escaped from the back door, and we see those three dinosaurs coming in on the left hand side of the page, and we see two archways and the open door on the right hand side, and when we look at that, the subtle things like the doormat that says wipe your talons, the post on the wall that says we are natural gas. These are subtle things that I assume you do want people to notice.
Well, that I want you, absolutely. And on a second reading or a third reading or, you know, something like that, usually I don't draw backgrounds, so I don't get to make these silly little jokes. And now in this book, because it's more traditional format, I get to put in these jokes. The we are natural gas. There's another one for the basketball team for the dinosaurs, which is called the Asteroids. Feel the boom. You know, for me, it's always been a thing. I'm not a big sports guy, but I've never understood why every team that we create is like a natural disaster. The hurricanes, the tornadoes, the earthquakes, the pestilence, the locusts.
It's yes. George Carlin did a wonderful routine on that, actually. And here again, also in that same frame, when you have the little dinosaur, there's a little Norway flag on his bed.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. There's a calendar at one point that says Norway, the gateway to Sweden.
Yes. Norway, the gateway to Sweden. And there's also this point where there's the first chair was too tall, the second chair was too tall, and the third chair was too tall. And Goldilocks looks very bewildered by all this and says, hey, what's going on around here? The bears that live here must be nuts. And it really is the point where she knows her place and what story she should be in. Going back to what you said earlier.
There is a question that, you know, this narrative isn't going the way it should. And I think that that happens often in all of our lives. You're in the middle of some situation and you say, wait, this story is not playing out the way that I think this story should be playing out. And then, you know, then you have a decision to make.
Would you think about, given, I assume, I mean, it's just out, but we assume success of this book, that you would retell another classic?
I don't know. I have no idea. I wouldn't do it for any other reason than I found a story that I really, really like. And so I don't think of my books in terms of, you know, oh, well, this, yeah, if this one does well, then I can make another one and that'll do well, or that kind of thing. The story really has to come first. And at this point, my attentions are elsewhere. I've got a lot of other projects that I'm doing, some grown-up projects, some theater projects, some other kid projects, and so my plate is full.
Again, the name of Mo Willems' new book is Goldilocks and the Three Dinosaurs, as retold by Mo Willems. He spoke with the Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue. You can learn more at gomo.net. They didn't have to deal with dinosaurs, but some Neanderthal behavior gives a hint to their intelligence. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. Recent archaeological discoveries are providing something of an image makeover for Neanderthals, long assumed to have been brutish and unintelligent. As Karen Hardy, research professor at the Autonomous University of Barcelona, explains, new evidence points to a level of thought once believed beyond the Neanderthal's capability.
Neanderthals were a species of hominid that lived in Europe and Western Asia to around 30,000 years ago. Until recently, they were understood to have been predominantly meat-eaters. El Cidrón is a well-known Neanderthal site in northern Spain and contains the remains of at least 13 individuals dating to around 50,000 years ago. In ancient populations where oral hygiene did not exist, most people had dental calculus. When plaque is not cleaned off teeth regularly, it calcifies and can remain for life. Recently, it's become clear that dental calculus is a store for biographical detail. We took samples of dental calculus from 5 individuals and conducted a suite of analyses on them. With Stephen Buckley, a collaborator on this project, we found tiny pieces of plant, including starch granules and a range of other biographical information trapped in the calculus. We found that this population of Neanderthals ate a range of starchy plants and probably also green vegetables, and that some of these foods had been roasted. We also found evidence that they had been near a wood smoke fire, had come into contact with bitumen, which was used by Neanderthals to bind some of their tools, and we found specific evidence for the plants yarrow and chamomile. Both these plants are bitter tasting and are used today for medicinal purposes, and neither has any nutritional value, so they were unlikely to have been part of the diet. We know from earlier work that these Neanderthals had the ability to identify bitter taste. Bitter taste often signals poison, so these Neanderthals clearly understood the properties of their plants. Self-medication fits into a wider pattern of behaviour, as all the higher primates today, including chimpanzees and gorillas, know and use many plants for medicinal purposes. Our new information shows Neanderthals to have had a more complex suite of knowledge and behavior than has hitherto been attributed to them.
That was Karen Hardy of the Autonomous University of Barcelona. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors on our website, academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.